Hello, and welcome to Kernel of Truth, a Cumulus Networks podcast where we focus on virtual veracity, legitimate Linux learning, and data center demystification. Whether we're discussing ASICs or back to the basics, you can count on Kernel of Truth for unique insight into the world of open networking. Our topic today is Day 2 Networking Operations. There's a lot to unpack here, but before we get into that, let's introduce ourselves. My name's Maddie. I work on the content production team in Cumulus Networks marketing department, and I am the regular host of the podcast, and I'm joined by two very special guests. Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Hey, I'm Pete Lumbus. I'm a technical marketing engineer here at Cumulus, both a CCIE and a CCDE.
I'm Rama Darba, and I'm a senior consultant here at Cumulus in the services organization.
All right. Well, I think that something that makes this podcast especially, well, special is that I heard through the grapevine that you two are not only podcast co-guests now, but at one point you were actually roommates before you started working at Cumulus.
That's true. I actually lived with Rama when he was learning how to play guitar in our open apartment, which I'm somehow still friends with him. It was extremely painful.
Yep. So Pete's patience was admirable, and I'd like to say I know how to play guitar now after that one brutal summer of almost 6 weeks.
But he definitely did not when we lived together.
Yeah, it was a rough set of 6 weeks.
It was like living with a 4-year-old with a recorder.
Yeah, I didn't know how many more times I needed to learn how to play Wonderwall before Pete was going to smash my guitar.
Oh no, you were that guy in college.
Yeah, you know.
Oh no.
Wonderwall drum circle in the middle of the quad. Come on, how else are you going to make friends?
He got really excited when he found the tabs for "Ants Marching" by Dave Matthews.
How many girlfriends did that get you, Rama?
Still working on it.
Okay, let's jump right into day two operations and troubleshooting. Pete, you seemed especially interested in this topic. You really wanted us to discuss it on the podcast. Tell us a little bit more about why you think it's so important to address.
Yeah, and I think part of that's just my background. So myself, as well as Rama, both worked in support when we were at Cisco as members of the global TAC. And so all we did was watch things get broken every day, and watch the kind of the pain, the struggle, the anxiety that creates. I mean, it's the hardest part of network engineering, in my opinion, is it's broken. What do I do about it? How do I do it? And I think when we look at new models of how to do things, we look at what Linux and networking has enabled, we can really bring a lot of new tooling to that environment so that I can start to build automated troubleshooting. I can start to script these runbooks that I have that I've given to my network operations team, and say, well, hit this button and have it either tell me the reason why it's broken because it's a known problem, or at least jumpstart that troubleshooting process for me.
Yeah, I think day two operations is so easily glossed over because it's easy to get caught up in the, you know, sexiness of new technology sometimes. And in a lot of enterprises, actually, the operations team is normally not pulled into the architectural design and implementation phase, which is generally considered more hip and exciting. It's more sales oriented, so you tend to meet with more vendors that way. And then once everything is selected and architecturally designed and deployed, then it's handed off to a completely different organization that may or may not wrap up two or three levels above. And at that point, you know, now you've got all these things that Pete was basically talking about. Now, how do you isolate problems? When do you decide to re-architect a solution because the problems are too systemic versus configuration changes? How do you even work with multiple operating systems? You definitely benefit from focusing on a day two operations kind of workflow.
That's actually one thing I think is really interesting is Microsoft released a paper out of their cloud networking group not too long ago. And they looked at, I want to say, 5 years of data out of the Azure Office 365 Microsoft public cloud and their operations. And what they found was that greater than 80% of all of their network failures or outages were caused by misconfigurations and human error. And that's really where a failure to get a rock solid, totally smoothed out automated operations led to failures, right? That has direct business impact, which costs our companies and our organizations money. And I think that was so telling to really prove what I think every network engineer knows, even if they're not willing to admit it, is that, you know what, most of the problems in networking are self-inflicted.
Yeah, I think day two operations, you nailed a couple of those key elements in day two operations topic, right? The first one was troubleshooting. How do you isolate problems when your deployed network all of a sudden is not behaving the way that you expect? And then you kind of touched on the next big part that I think is really interesting, which is configuration management, right? There's no way that an environment deployed in, you know, time equals zero, right, is going to be the exact same in time equals 6 months. New applications get built up, requirements change, whatever, right? So how do you manage the configuration changes throughout that now that the architecture team is completely removed and is almost completely ops driven, right? And then in addition to that, another big factor is, you know, compliance through code version and configuration, right? New vulnerabilities are constantly coming out. How do you manage code revisioning in that? And how do you handle updating configs and removing features that you don't need that are maybe crop up as vulnerable that you need to have a workaround for, right?
You know, now that you mentioned it, let's talk about configuration management a little bit more.
10 years ago, you have a problem, right? You have to go find the device having the issue, and you basically analyze that problem on a node-by-node basis to kind of isolate issues. And it's tough, right? So, like, the reason that troubleshooting workflow operated that way is because configuration management was handled that way. Configurations were basically made by hand, right? And then typed by a human being into a command prompt onto a switch. So if you had 6 devices in your environment, yeah, it's pretty easy. Now you have 100, you're still doing the exact same methodology. You're just doing it across 100 switches, right?
It's artisanal, bespoke, free-range configurations.
Right, exactly. So that's where we were 10 years ago. And I contend that's where the industry really started. And then now we hear terms like automation a lot, right? Or even just standardization. And I think that is really where the industry is going. And it's on the cusp because everyone's doing it a little bit different way. And I contend that some of the big, more clever network engineers or even just, you know, IT engineers that are probably listening to this have already been doing this in some way, probably written bash scripts to back up their configs, probably had some basic diff tooling in whatever, you know, IDE they like to use or editor that they like to use to be able to compare, oh, I got this backup 2 months ago and I got this backup now. What are the diffs between them and what should be it like?
And there's tools like Rancid or Oxidize that folks in the networking industry have been using for years to every night reach out at midnight, pull the current config, compare it to yesterday's copy and see where it is. But even those things I think end up falling short because you're now 24 hours behind at best. But also all that's doing is showing me changes to that configuration. It doesn't tell me anything within a broader context. So just because I have something configured doesn't mean it works.
Yeah, and it also felt almost like a shoehorned solution to the inherent challenges with node-by-node configuration management. Just like you're saying, you might end up with a bunch of snowflakes because now you're relying on human beings to enforce consistency in configuration, which is tough. Inherently, we are flawed individuals and working on things. You get distracted, you get other priorities, you might not be able to focus exclusively on something. So, you know, you end up with maybe 30% of your network non-compliant through configuration. You leftover configs from TAC troubleshooting, right? Oh, I put in a capture and now I never removed it and it's just sitting on my box, right? And I forgot to node out because we ended this web sharing session or desktop troubleshooting session just immediately after we found the problem. Or we get a workaround, right? And we only put on one out of the 15 other switches that need it, right? So these kind of like snowflakes cause an issue with that. The backups will tell you that, but it doesn't enforce that conformance. You still end up with the fundamental workflow challenges of having to log into every node and do that.
I think part of that is like, I don't have that context. So if I create a GRE tunnel to solve a problem, it might not be the long-term solution. That's my workaround, but until the maintenance window happens or until that new circuit gets spun up. And then the new circuit comes up and the GRE tunnel acts as, I don't want to call it a backup because I don't intend for it to be a backup anymore, but it still lives there as this time bomb waiting to go off. And I'll find it. I'll probably find it at 11 p.m. on a Friday while I'm like out to dinner with my wife and kids. But that's kind of the way we are. And I think we're, you know, as you said, we're seeing that evolution of the industry. I think that evolution is looking at better tooling so that I can understand what is there, why is it there, and what does it do? Because if I'm looking at config in isolation, I can say, okay, well, there's a GRE tunnel, but I don't know what it does. I'm missing that key component.
I really enjoy listening to the back and forth between you guys. It's really awesome. But I do forget sometimes that there are points I want to go back to because I just sort of get trapped in Pete's NPR golden voice
And I just sort of will believe whatever you tell me as well. Like, the president is secretly a lizard man. I just be like, yeah, thank you for telling me, Pete. But I wanted to go back to something Rama said earlier. And you mentioned something about us being on the cusp. And if we're on the edge of that, what's either holding us back or what's not pushing us forward?
Pete and I always talk about this all the time because we want to see the industry where we would like to be, which is like a fully automated infrastructure. So when it comes to configuration management, I think there's probably maybe three things that are holding people back primarily. Commitment to a new tooling feature set, right? And finding that right feature set for you, right? So that's one big factor. So kind of like that CapEx sort of, what technology am I going to invest in? Now, then inherently, the one that follows up with that is, oh man, how do I skill up my staff to be able to use this feature set? And then the third one is more esoteric. It's, can I get my staff and my workflows to commit to this new paradigm, even though it is going to be tough for like a couple of months as we don't fall into bad habits of logging into individual devices and, you know, storing configs as flat text files as a backup. And we move more towards a system-based management structure using these new skills that I've provided that. Because the first two you can solve, but the third one takes real commitment and will to like force your organization to commit to this new paradigm. Otherwise, inherently, we're humans. We will backslide to what we're most comfortable with, right? Just because we can do it faster.
Yeah,
right?
we're almost getting into like a philosophical debate about like the downfalls of humanity. Like, we put errors into everything. We're fallible. We're too lazy to keep up with things that are actually better for us.
I'm right here. I mean, I'm taking some offense to this.
I'm just saying, maybe Skynet should take over. Maybe it's better for us.
Yeah. But if we're talking about like what's holding people back, I would say the first two are actually pretty easy to solve. The first thing I said, which is picking the right tooling, that can come from an architectural team or some sort of leadership. The training, you throw money at that problem. You know, there's a lot of knowledge out there to be able to learn that, whether it's free on the internet, whether that's forums or formalized trainings, right? Or even some sort of consultative services that come in. Like, there's lots of organizations that can help at each one of those. The hardest part is the third part, like committing to it, because no one can make you do that except the will of your own organization.
I mean, leave it up to the consultant to say that really the solution to this problem is consulting.
Money, please.
In Rama's defense, though, even though I'm on the marketing team, I did have to go through a Cumulus Linux training and we learned about configurations and going through all of that. And it was actually very helpful, even at my level, which is marketing. I think that there's a lot to be said for putting a lot of money into really good training.
But I think part of this is, how do we look at those attitudes that create the negative outcomes and leverage those to create positive outcomes? And I think the easiest one is like the path of least resistance. So how do we build tooling and features and capabilities for our teams where using those tools will not only improve their day-to-day operations and make their lives better, but it's also the easiest thing for them to do. And I think the easiest thing to look at there is some of the virtual environments that, you know, Cumulus or other vendors have built, where how do I kind of build a virtual representation of what's going on? And now I can go play around with it there because I don't break production trying to learn OSPF and, you know, get yelled at. I can break it in this virtual environment.
So we talked about what's preventing us from going over the edge right now. What do you think would push us over the edge? How would we break that?
I think, again, it's the tooling. Like, I own a power drill because screwdrivers are kind of crummy tools. And I want to use that better tool to solve the same problem. And I think in networking, that cusp is we're seeing kind of the birth of some of these tools, especially that the server people have had for years, if not decades. And we're just starting to get some of those tools. And I think the growth and the maturity of those tools are really going to start to push things over the edge.
Yeah, I totally agree. If you build it, they will come. I fundamentally believe in that. Early adopters will go out of their way to learn new tooling, right? And then we'll understand that. But as you get into that middle of that bell curve of, you know, daily use and the entire industry, you need to make it as easily accessible and easy to use as possible. So its value is inherent to the tool itself, right? And I think we're not quite there yet.
And I think just to be concrete, when we keep saying tooling, I think to me a huge part of that is our virtual environments, and not only virtual environments, but virtual environments that are accurate. How accurate or valuable is that virtual machine? So if that virtual machine doesn't give me layer two capabilities, or it can't run VXLAN, or if it can't do the things that I'm doing in production, then it's nearly valueless. And so it's cool that they exist. I can start to do some things, but I can't actually improve operations. And I actually think that's one place where Linux has been really powerful, is looking at the Linux model, and the Linux kernel allows you to build fully featured virtual machines so that I can give an exact one-to-one analog of my production data center. And I can give one copy to my new person so they can go skill up and train and understand what production looks like. I can give another copy to my operations team so when things break, they can say, well, what is expected behavior? Because I know this is a problem we had a lot, is I would see an output and I'd be like, yeah, that's an output. I don't know if it's a good output or a bad one, but it's definitely, I ran a command and something came back. And then I think the third part is managing those what-if scenarios, right? We're going to go into that maintenance window on Friday night or Saturday night. And what's going to happen? And having true analogs allow us to know what's going to happen ahead of time so I can go into those changes and do my operations with confidence.
Yeah, and I think that last part is just super valuable. Without getting into the, you know, the more detailed topics around, like we discussed, automation or how to manage your entire network as a singular entity and node, one of the most critical elements here is just having this sandbox and virtual environment to be able to test configuration. And that'll create a very nice configuration management workflow where everything that you put in, you have confidence in, and it holds a greater level of accountability, much more than just say, are we ready for the maintenance window? Yeah, go check your email. It's in the body of the email, the thing I'm going to copy and paste in. It's like, well, where did you test this? How do you know that those are the commands? Like, where's the validation that this will actually work so my 30-minute maintenance window doesn't turn into a three-hour maintenance window, right? And,
I mean, you're lucky if you got Notepad. Like, the hierarchy I always saw was Notepad was the best solution. You literally wrote it down in Notepad and emailed the Notepad attachment. The next level up was, it was the body of the email, so probably had some hidden characters.
Yeah. Or, and unformatted and like non-fixed width text.
It's Comic Sans. The next sad part, you know, in the layer of change management sadness was the Word doc.
Oh, man.
And then, you know, where it's actually got like the wrong line returns.
Yeah, it's all text wrapped.
and then if your operations are really terrible, and I know that there's somebody listening who's lived this, it's the screenshots of the Word document, and the screenshots get emailed around, and that's what's approved.
The screenshot of the Word document, and then every time it's downloaded and re-uploaded, the resolution gets a little bit worse.
You know, I think at some point, if you send that to Bill Gates and five of your friends, like, he sends you money.
I think, and then I've actually received just the link to the doc. Oh, yeah, you want to enable this feature? Absolutely. It's in this doc, right? For the maintenance window, we'll just follow the doc. It's like, did you validate what in the doc we actually need to put in and create? Like, that's another like cowboyish tactic that I've seen, where it's easy to be like, yeah, I'm ready for the maintenance window. I'm just going to read this doc live and copy and paste commands in and hope I get it right.
YOLO ops is not ops.
Yeah. But it's tough, right? Because it's hard to find time and everything like that. And a lot of the time, the reason it's tough is because working without validation feels very unrewarding. Now, what the virtual environment lets you do is gives you more reward to be able to do that stuff beforehand.
Right. Do you think that there's a screenshot out there of one of those Word documents that's been floating around for so long and just degenerated from the era of the chainmail days, and one day you're going to open your inbox and you'll see it again, and it'll have that, if you don't send this within 5 minutes, you're going to be cursed for 7 years, but send it in 2 minutes and you'll have good luck and get a new car?
Look, even Nigerian princes need networks.
We should start a maintenance window chainmail. If you don't forward, every maintenance window you have for the next 7 years will go long. No, I'll forward it. No.
Forward this email or your supervisors will fail over.
Yeah.
Just wanted to go into a quick little fun bit I like to do sometimes at the end of podcasts. It's called Guess the Definition. I found some words that can sometimes be applied to maybe your coworkers when you're in networking, and I wanted to pose them to you and see if any of you know the definitions. Rama is looking incredibly enthusiastic. I know he loves it when I bring him on the podcast and make him play a game.
You know, this is my first time doing this, but I really hope this doesn't end in us getting one of those explicit warnings on iTunes.
That's what we have Andrea for. She'll bleep that all out. Actually, please don't make her job harder.
Yeah, we'll be right up there with the Wu-Tang Clan. It'll be baller. All right, let's do this.
You could not have sounded less baller when saying baller.
One should remember that much like the Wu-Tang Clan, network engineers ain't nothing with.
Thank you for censoring yourself so Andrea didn't have to do it. Imagine you're in the office. If you were referred to someone as a seagull, what would a seagull's role on your networking team be?
Is that just an observer?
You mean like a bird? Like an albatross?
Think metaphorically. Dive into language a little bit.
Seagull. I feel like I'm being set up here. I've never called one of my colleagues a seagull, and I've never been called a seagull to my face, maybe behind my back.
If it helps, the definition implies you would not say it to their face.
All right, I'm going to speculate here. I think it is someone who is always, because seagulls are scavengers, so it's someone who is willing to always complain but not do any of the work to fix it, if I had to guess.
Pete, alternate definition, agree, disagree?
I think a seagull, when I think of seagulls, I think of like sitting at the beach and trying to eat while shooing away the sky raccoons. So I'm going to guess a seagull is the person that always eats your sandwich out of the fridge.
I actually really like your definition because I've been the victim of that multiple times now. And I think we should establish some company corporal punishment for that. But actually, Ram is completely right. The seagull from the definition I received is that manager or coworker who swoops in, makes a lot of noise, dumps on everything, and then flies away.
Can I edit Urban Dictionary and then just say that you were wrong?
You know, Urban Dictionary is like the ultimate lexicon that people go to when they're in need of definition. So by all means.
It's the Wikipedia of our language. What's the French school that defines the French language?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I can't remember it, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Urban Dictionary is basically the English version of that.
Yeah, I have a degree in English and I learned French and I don't know what that is. So I am useless in two languages, I guess.
That's all right. I can barely speak either.
Well, you know, computing language. It's a language. All right. I think we're about ready to wrap things up. Pete, Rama, any final thoughts for our listeners?
Yeah, this is something that's just been near and dear to my heart is that whole idea of virtualization, that ability to virtualize and simulate that network. And I think that's one of the areas where, you know, some vendors do it well, some do it extremely poorly, but I think everybody in industry should be pushing their vendors to give them that power, because I think this is one of the biggest thing holding us back from being successful in every aspect of what we do as network operators. And so having those super accurate virtual environments is kind of unlimited power for network operations.
So in my opinion, my closing thought would be really around how do you enforce configuration standardization? There's nothing worse than logging into a box and then looking at a line of configuration and trying to wonder why it was put in, how it was put in, and whether I still need it or not. And then validating against another box that is similar role and it doesn't have that configuration line, which one is my source of truth, right? And that kind of function, I think, is where we really need to be as an industry to be able to standardize that behavior, right? And the configuration management in a, you know, modern or open networking paradigm can enforce that through a lot of native tooling that has been already solved that way in the server world, for example, because they have so many more nodes to manage that becomes much more problematic at scale. So being able to leverage some of the tooling that they've used and have already experienced with, as you go down that and like, what is a solution for that? You kind of end up down these rows of centralized configuration management through Git, automation through Ansible or Puppet to push configs, right? Templating using Jinja 2. Now, all of those are just specific tools to solve the underlying problem, but the true problem that you're trying to solve is how do you enforce standardization? And the true, you know, modernized way that I think Pete and I would like to see configuration management handle is through standardization, right? And right now, I think it's enforced reactively through backing up configs and then diffing them. But that doesn't give you intelligence into why.
All right. Well, thank you both, Pete and Rama, for joining me. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in. And if you listened today and you're interested in testing out a virtual appliance that lets you preview networking technology, maybe head on over to our website and try out Cumulus VEX. It's completely free. You're able to preview and test open networking technology, prototype, build sandboxes, all of that. So if you want to head over and download it, feel free to try it out for yourself. Also, be sure to subscribe to the podcast, follow us on Twitter and on Slack, and let us know if you have any questions or topics that you want us to address. Your feedback could appear in an episode in the future. Thanks again, and see you later.